Hi, welcome to the CTO to CTO podcast. In today's Pioneers episode, our guest is Sasha Vidoborsky, the principal at Atomico. Sasha shares over 10 years of investing experience with us, including the best and worst cases he's seen in his career. He discusses what is at the core of the venture capital business, explains his process for sourcing talent, and shares why being ambitious and having a game changer mindset are his most important categories for an upcoming entrepreneur. This episode guarantees great advice for anyone entering business and looking for investors, VCs, and supporters who will help take their company to the next level.
Hi, guys. In CTO to CTO episodes, we are circling around three main topics: enterprise software, open source, and e-commerce. So far, my guests were software vendors, founders, and managers in charge of digital transformation. Apparently, it's like we are having folks creating the technology and its users. I thought it would be great to have a look from different angle. In today's episode, my guest is Sasha Vidoborsky, principal of Atomico Venture Capital Fund. Atomico invested in dozens of companies, including Rovio, Klarna, Pipedrive. Before joining Atomico, Sasha worked at Runa Capital, a firm well known for investing into open source, enterprise open source products like Nginx, Kelimetrics, and MariaDB. We are going to talk about the VC fund perspective, business models, raising technology trends, and open source. Hello, Sasha. Thank you for accepting my invitation.
Hey, Peter, and thanks for inviting me. It's super nice to be here.
That's awesome. Do you know that you are the first venture capitalist being interviewed by me in this podcast?
No, it's actually a great honor, and looking forward to our conversation. It's kind of a huge bar for me as well. It's quite high for to be like a first venture capitalist.
So maybe we first get a little bit into your background of your career, how you get into a VC funds, the early days of your career. How would it look like?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you have conversations with entrepreneurs, you always introduce yourself. And sometimes I have like a 3-minute intro, sometimes like a 10-second intro. in many cases, I kind of have certain leaps because obviously you don't want to tell the entire story. But my story started in science. So I'm trained as a quantum physicist. That was over a decade ago. Back in the days, quantum was not a thing, like not everyone, like literally there were very few people that heard about quantum computing at that time. So I started my career working in a lab, basically building quantum computers, but quite quickly realized that I probably want to do something more applicable. And then after that, I started my own company. We were doing AI for emotion recognition. And the main idea was, well, if we can detect how people react to advertising, we can probably improve that advertising.
Oh, interesting.
Then I was with a company in Estonia called Bitcom that was doing backup and recoveries for small and medium enterprises. I was their first business hire, was with them for a bit less than a year. And that was super interesting journey because obviously kind of getting into the tech with more business related activities was very cool. And then right after that, I joined basically Runa. And then I spent 2.5 years investing in things across the spectrum with probably more angle towards open source and developer tools. So that's something that I found personally fascinating. And that's why I kind of continued to do that going into the future endeavors. And then I did an MBA in the US and then joined Atomico shortly after that. So I've been with Atomico for almost a year and a half now.
Gotcha. Very interesting story. And, you started with quantum physics. I think it's a space, a topic for most of us seem like the most difficult thing you can imagine. So you ate that frog, like started with something really tough in the early days of your career. So was it like everything else, everything further the path was just easy for you?
No, I think all of the things there were super hard, but it's in its own manner. I think quantum is hard because you need to have a lot of prior knowledge. It's not something where you can jump on things and kind of figure it on the fly.
Yeah.
That's where probably the most complexity is coming from. But if you're familiar with that, it's kind of, it's fine. I had colleagues who were much smarter than I was, and they were like kind of cracking nuts with everything related to that. Building my own company was a very different challenge, but probably the most challenging thing in my life, just because you're on your own. You don't have kind of people to support you. You need to hire, you need to raise capital. Yeah. There are so many things that
everything
you need to
is
do.
On you. Yeah, everything
yeah,
is
exactly.
on you.
And there is no one that stands behind your back and says, well, this is right, this is wrong, right? You make your own decisions. And I think that was the biggest transformational experience for me. And then being an early joiner for another company is another challenge, because now suddenly you don't make all of the decisions and you need to persuade people. You need to make sure that everyone is aligned. And then switching to VC, it was another another angle, because obviously there you want to be helpful to people, but there is so much you can do, obviously. And I think many people have this misperception about VC that it's a fancy job where you just sit on the couch and you write checks. And it's actually not, because obviously there are so many things you need to do right, and there are so many people that you want to help. But probably what quantum physics taught me is tolerance to ambiguity and tolerance to hard things. It's not like you see like an equation for the first time and you say, well, if I don't crack it in 10 minutes, I'll kind of I'll jump off. You need to sit there and kind of persevere, and you need to make sure that you can deliver on what is expected. So all of the things were important and useful. I can't say that any of the steps that I just mentioned were deliberate. In many cases, it was just luck that I was in the right place at the right time. So I wish I could say that I knew what I was doing. I had no idea, to be honest.
So you haven't had a plan made in stone. It was rather learning by doing story.
Well, it was more, well, like this challenge sounds cool. I should go and figure out, right? It was not
Absolutely.
Like I had this idea. Yeah. I want to be in VC at the end of the day, and that's why I need to do this five things. It was more, well, it's a new challenge, sounds cool. I should go and figure it out. And that ultimately was probably the right thing for my personality. But for many others, it might seem too chaotic.
Sounds really interesting. And what I have learned so far is that quantum physics and entrepreneurship is actually pretty much related to each other. Let's talk Atomico. What's the story of this fund? And tell us, please, more a little bit about the partners, your investment strategy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So Atomico was started almost 15 years ago, originally by Nico Zemstrom, who is the founder and CEO of Skype. And basically, back in the day when he was building Skype, he obviously had to raise a lot of capital. And besides capital, what he really needed was hands-on support, because at that time, that was like 2006, not that many companies were started from Europe. So there were not that many people you can rely on for advice and for hands-on support in terms of the things that they have done themselves.
Yeah.
So from that perspective, when he exited Skype, he decided, well, if this is something that I needed back at the time, maybe this is something that others need as well. So he decided to start a venture capital firm. Fast forward 15 years from that time, we're now investing out of our fifth fund, which is $820 million. Overall, we have over $3 billion in assets under the management. That's probably one of the biggest standalone early stage funds.
Yep.
And the strategy has pretty much stayed the same. We're focused at Series A Europe-based companies. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the bulk of our investments going into, probably 70 to 75%. And then we selectively do what we call venture growth investments. This is Series B, C, and D. Mm-hmm. And if previously it was pretty much anywhere in the world, we have a few investments in Latin America and Brazil. We have a few investments in Asia and so on. But yeah. Probably since Fund 4, we are focused for venture growth. We are focused on US and Europe. And the core idea here is that for Europe-based companies, we help them scale to the US. For US companies, we help them scale to Europe. And the way we help them is that we have operating partners in-house. So these are people that are former senior executives or managers or entrepreneurs that were responsible for specific functions. So if we have an operating partner that was a former head of Google EMEA, and he scaled Google from 70 people to 7,000 people. And that's what he does for our portfolio company. So anything related to recruiting, to work structure, to pretty much people side of the business, he can help you with that. And then we have another partner, Kara, who did the same at Twitter. And then we have a similar types of profiles for go-to-market, for international expansion, for branded communication. And that's when we invest, we basically deploy these resources to our portfolio companies so they could have these people and have this hands-on support that they might some other cases miss.
That sounds very cool. And I think it's not that often that, let's say pretty late stage, A round is not seed, is not pre-seed. At this stage, I didn't see often that VC is offering this kind of, let's say, smart money, like putting experienced executives. I guess if you need it in your company to help you, I think this is really helpful. This is really cool value you provide. That's really awesome.
Yeah, Duran, I think. We were started in 2006, and since then, obviously, many funds have been started in Europe, and many more provide hands-on support these days, which is awesome, because I think at Series A specifically, that's where it becomes more about execution rather than about conviction. So from that perspective, this is what entrepreneurs need. And if the market supports that this is really cool. And we are trying to be mindful and also kind of innovate on that front, because obviously we were one of the first ones to start that. And we keep innovating. And there are a few things that are being kind of cooked right now. So hopefully you'll see more on that front as well.
Awesome. I'm wondering, what are the criteria you have for the companies applying to Atomico? Is there any specific business model or industry or technology or team structure? Like how the criteria looks like?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So I think at Atomico, we're vertical agnostic. Which means that basically we invest across the spectrum. We invest into anything from deep tech. We are investor in Lilium, which is a flying electric vehicle company in Germany. We're investor in Graphcore, the AI chip manufacturer, up to more traditional software. We're investor in MessageBird. We're investor in Klarna, as you mentioned, Pipedrive, and a bunch of others. And I think for different companies, there will be different things that we would like to explore. But in general, I think what is specific to Atomico is a few things. First is the level of ambition that the founders have and their capabilities. Because obviously what we're looking for is to find Skype-like opportunities. So companies and teams that can transform their respective fields. The same way Skype became a category-defining software for voice over IP, the same we want to back companies that will become category-defining in their respective fields. We call those companies game changers, because whatever they do, they should change the rules of the game. So that's one thing. Second is obviously more kind of plain vanilla things like market size, innovation that is happening because of the technology that the team is developing and the traction. And the third, which probably should be the first, is the the talent magnetism that the founders have, because obviously it's very hard to build a game-changing company if you can't attract best-in-class talent. And it's not only about the credentials, because obviously I think people sometimes get fixated on like credentials, like, oh, this guy worked at Google or at Amazon or whatever. It's more about like whether these people are passionate about the idea they're going after, whether these are the people that can deliver on the promise. Because I think at early stage, before Series A, it's a lot about the vision. At Series A, it becomes a bit more about whether you can deliver on that vision. So it becomes more tangible, right? And if you cannot support your vision with evidence, that's probably not a good fit for a proper Series A. You maybe need a bit more validation for that. But if you get that, that's probably the best time to go in and raise a Series A.
Absolutely. I'm really glad you said that. It's all about the execution, and the execution is actually all about the people. So the founding team plus the people they can hire. And you already said that two important features of successful founder are the passion, the magnetism they have for other people. And what other features define the successful founding team? Maybe it's even good to discuss this separately, like the successful founder, but also the successful founding team.
No, that's actually a very good distinction, I think. And like if you think at the core of VC business, I think it's all about people in one form or another. Mm-hmm. And if you think about founders, vision definitely is one, and whether they can articulate that vision and whether they can deliver on that vision. The second is talent magnet, as I mentioned, because obviously you want to be surrounded by people that are better than you. Mm-hmm. And the third one, like there are many words that can describe it, but I would probably use like grit or tenacity, which means that you need to persevere. And with entrepreneurial journey, there will be so many things that go the wrong way. Some of them go south, some others go just sideways. And you need to persevere, and you need to make sure that you can go this journey or go this way and not stop, or actually know when to stop. Because obviously what we see in many cases, I mean, you know the stats, 9 out of 10 companies die. And I think with the best entrepreneurs that I've seen, they know when it's time to call it a day, because obviously there are so many, kind of the way we call them is like walking zombies. Like the companies that are here, they're doing something, but they're not really growing. Like the team is not growing. Like no one is excited. I mean, everyone would be so happy and relieved to go into the next thing, but no one has kind of got to say, well, probably the idea or the market or the product doesn't work. We need to either pivot or do something else. And from that perspective, this combination of being pragmatic and being optimistic, but at the same time realistic and persevering, that's probably the best quality that I've seen in my kind of journey as a venture capitalist. I've seen makes companies break or make.
Gotcha. That makes perfect sense. But how it relates to the team structure? What is the successful startup team? Because I guess having just one very pragmatic people with grit is not enough. Like you, for example, this is great for dealing with the problems, issues, obstacles. But you need to have someone else who is more optimistic, maybe pushing for growth, not seeing all those obstacles because otherwise get demotivated.
No, that's a very actually good point. And I think the best teams that we've seen were the teams where it's not necessarily, well, I mean, it's cheesy for me to say they should be balanced, right? It's ideally, you would like to see balanced team where you have like a very prominent CTO, then you have like a CEO that is like a super smart leader, then you have a commercial person that kind of can hustle around and kind of get the customers out of nowhere and so on. Unfortunately or fortunately, like many cases where we see, these are not, I would say, feature complete teams. But what definitely makes a difference is when you have complementary skill sets. So when you have a person who is more interested in the tech stack and tech parts of the business, and when you have a person who is more interested in business side, you can call them like whatever you want. You can call him or her CEO or chief commercial officer or COO.
Yeah.
But there should be someone who kind of drives forward the business, and there should be someone who drives forward the tech part. And I think the best thing is when these two people can communicate to each other, because the moment they can't understand what are the priorities, that's probably when it goes south. And obviously it depends on the type of the business, because if you're building like an e-commerce shop, it's a very different value proposition. It's a very different skill set required versus when you're building, I don't know how, like a dev tool, right? Because obviously the types of the customers you'll be going after, types of the challenges you'll be tackling are entirely different.
Makes perfect sense. I also heard that sometimes the golden rule is you need to have a hustler, hipster, and hacker, somebody very into tech, which is hacker, creative product guy, which is hipster, and hustler, who's more into commercial. But yeah, I think that those three or two roles must be there to make it successful. Absolutely. How many startups you review per month? You personally, as a partner.
I think it's a good question. I don't have a count on that. Probably, and it depends how you define review. I think there are different levels of engagement. So from just looking at a website to looking at a deck to having a conversation to having like an in-depth conversation and so on and so forth. I probably review on average maybe 50 to 100 companies a month. And the only reason being because I'm quite focused on specific verticals and specific areas. Obviously, we are generalists, so I look at everything. But more proactively, I look at companies that are in my field of responsibility and in my field of interest. And definitely something that is on top of my mind is how we can review more, because there is 24 hours a day, so you can't spend all of your day looking at new opportunities, and you need to make sure that you can dedicate time to the opportunities that will make a difference. I think, as I mentioned in the beginning, 9 out of 10 startups will die. They just die.
Yeah.
The reason behind it, probably because some of the fundamentals were wrong. So I think one of the critical skill sets that VCs develop throughout their career is spot this early signs of something going wrong early, because obviously you want to spend time on companies that have the highest probability. And I think it goes both ways, because sometimes we pass on opportunities and we say, well, this thing is wrong, right? But then entrepreneurs, because of their perseverance and grit, they go and actually prove it otherwise, not because they want to prove it to us or to someone else, but because fundamentally they believe in something. And I think these are the best opportunities. If you think about the ones that deliver the most value to shareholders and, of course, to investors, these are the ones that are not obvious. So these are the ones that the bulk of the market thinks is crap, but one or two or three people think that this is a kind of a diamond in the rough, and entrepreneurs go and prove it. So that's why I think we need to be open-minded, and we are open-minded, and we will be the first one to admit that we were wrong. And there are so many cases where we pass on an opportunity at Series A, and then we go and pursue the opportunity at Series B or C, because there were some things that we either missed or that we were missing. And by the time of Series B, entrepreneurs go and kind of prove that, and we kind of chase them afterwards, because obviously we will be the one, as I mentioned, to say the first kind of that we were wrong, and we're super glad that you were able to prove otherwise.
Absolutely. I really like what you said, that sometimes it's like self-fulfilling prophecy, and sometimes it's not. Like, you see something is wrong within the startup, and they just can fix it. They can probably even ignore it because it's not that important for this individual particular case. Yeah. And it can still work. And probably we are going back to the fundamentals you said and the founding team, because if they have features of character to deal with those problems, they probably do. So the next question I had in my mind is, if you review, say, 20 or 50, maybe 20 or even 10 in more deep details per month, 20 startups, what usually works great and what usually not? Like, I'm a startup, and statistically, before talking with me, what works well and what's not? What's your intuition?
That's a great question. I think there are a few signals that we try to pick up that sometimes work, but sometimes not. And because we invest at Series A, we don't do seed, we don't do pre-seed. So from that perspective, we have a bit more data to rely on. Yeah. So, well, that being said, as a caveat here, I personally speak to many earlier stage startups just because I want to build relationship with people, and I want to help them along their journey, only kind of meet them like few weeks before they go and raise, because people say kind of getting a VC on board is like getting married, and it's pretty much like that, but it's not getting married for the entrepreneurs. It's also getting married for the VC, right? So you need to make sure that you can work with those people. So I personally speak to entrepreneurs very early. And, from that perspective, that allows me to also build personal relationships with them. But getting back to your initial question, I think what we definitely check is whether there are initial signs of product market fit. For instance, if we hear great things from the customers, I think customer love is something, and I'm doing a lot of enterprise investments. So customer love is probably one of the primary drivers that shows that the company has found product market fit. The second is if they're able to grow the team, that shows A, that they have resources to grow the team. So probably the company is growing, but also B, that they need those people, because obviously if you hire, there are roles and there are tasks to be filled with those people. So that's the second one. And the third one is some of the more vanity metrics, and it depends on types of the startup. Sometimes it's traffic on the website. Sometimes it's number of customers that they onboard each week or each month, and so on and so forth. So those are the ones that work quite well. The ones that don't work that well or won't work for specific opportunities, for instance, in general, VCs try to invest in companies that have not been on the market for like ages. So for instance, if the company has already been on the market for like 10 years and they have not reached meaningful scale, well, the obvious question is like, why would they reach the scale if they get money from us? But sometimes that proves wrong, right? Because you have so many bootstrapped companies that, well, they are doing fine, and suddenly they want to actually go beyond their limit. They want to get capital. So there were so many examples, like OnePassword, for instance. Like, the company has been on the market for like ages, right? And their first Series A round was like 200 million or something, which is like enormous amount of capital.
Oh.
So the time that the company has been on the market is not probably the right metric kind of to unanimously judge on that. The second is the category itself. I think people get excited about things quite quickly when they hear them. I mean, entrepreneurs use so many buzzwordy descriptions, like we're using AI, we're using cloud native, we're using whatever, right? And I think, or low code, no code is a particular thing right now. So I think we dig very deep into what that means. So we would really sit on the call with the CTO and ask him to explain us the architecture of the software, explain us like where the AI is coming into play, where the data is coming, and so on and so forth. So from that perspective, we try not to go into this mode of, well, let's jump on the next shiny thing and kind of really dig into what that actually means. And I know that many other VCs do that as well, but I think we're particularly, and we heard that from multiple entrepreneurs, that we're particularly diligent about that. And lastly, I think another thing that sometimes works well, sometimes not, is credentials of the founding team. So for instance, if you were like a VP at Google, the common perception is that you'll be able to figure it out. Mm-hmm. In probably 90% of the cases, that is the case. But there is this like 10% where people are able to raise like enormous amount of capital. I mean, there are so many cases in the Valley where people are able to raise like $200-$400 million without even releasing the product. And then they don't find product market fit. And that's fine, as long as you know that that might happen. And I think people who bet on those teams are the ones that can afford it themselves. I think in our particular case, we definitely take into consideration that, but we also try to understand whether this is the right team for a particular opportunity, whether this is the team that have done it, right? Yeah. If someone was a VP of marketing at Google, it doesn't mean that he or she will be able to build the best in class fintech product, because fintech sometimes requires a bit different mindset and a bit different lens. So this will probably be the three that I would highlight as the ones that we need to be careful with.
Makes perfect sense. So there is no single thing. It must work all together, like the product market fit, the founders, and the team, and you know, the traction must be also there. Makes perfect sense. You said that you are active in particular verticals, you yourself, and Dr. Miko. What are those verticals?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, we are generalists. So we look at things across the spectrum. My personal kind of probably three topics are open source as a kind of a broad category, and as a distribution model, because I think it requires a certain focus when you think about companies that are doing something open source versus more closed source software. The second one is developer tools. And sometimes there is overlap. There are like open source developer tools, but there are many other categories of tools that will not be developer tools that will be open source, like things in data, for instance, and data infrastructure that are targeted to engineers and data scientists. And we have another team member and a few actually team members that are focused on data, but I support them on open source for data, so to say.
Gotcha.
And the third one, which might be an outlier in light of first two, is remote work.
So remote work.
Yeah, I think, it might sound off the chart here, but I'm very intrigued and very fascinated by the shift that we're going through right now. And anything that enables more effective remote work, either on the collaboration and communication side or maybe on productivity, that's something that I'm actively looking at. And we recently did an investment in the summer that I also took part of in a company called Catalog that is basically trying to bridge different applications. So instead of you working in like hundreds of applications that you might have in your workday routine, you would connect those applications to Catalog and you would kind of use that as operating system or air traffic control for all of the applications.
Interesting. Yesterday, I just recorded interview with Gabriel Engel, founder of Rocket Chat. Which is it's probably on the crossing of all those three areas of your interest, because it's very successful open source. It's kind of developers tools because they have marketplace and great APIs, but it's also mainly the remote work environment. I would say environment. It's not a Slack copy. It's much more. It was a very interesting story.
I spoke to him back in probably 2016 or 2017. When they started. And he was, I'm not sure where he is now geographically, but at that time he was in Latin America, in Brazil or somewhere, which was like a very interesting ways to start an open source project, right?
Because he's in Porto Alegre based. It was great talk. Not sure if this episode would be before this one or not, but guys, if you are interested, go to cto.com and episodes. It must be there somewhere in there. Okay, let's talk the open source for a while, because this is something very interesting for me. How investing into open source products looks like from VC perspective, because it's not that obvious, right? And it makes sense, any sense from VC perspective, or does it?
No, I think it's a great question. And I think many questions are still scratching their head about this. In my perspective, so I first started looking at open source back in 2015 when I was at Runa. Mm-hmm. Runa, as you mentioned, historically has invested in many prominent open source companies like Nginx, probably one of the most successful open source exit out there. And back in the day, there were like very few people, A, that were doing open source in Europe, and B, that were looking at investing in open source, because obviously open source has a different flavor in terms of commercial success and in terms of unit economics and all other things that VC like to check. So from the VC perspective, I think the situation a bit changed in 2017 when obviously Red Hat was acquired, and then later GitHub. Mm-hmm. GitHub was acquired, and then there were so many good IPOs like MongoDB, Elastic, and others, which in a nutshell proved that actually open source has a business model that works. It works differently, but it works, and it can produce mm-hmm. a lot of successful companies. So since then, I've personally seen so many good companies being started, but also many more people being interested in investing in open source. When you think about investing in open source, one question that is on my mind is like, what is the difference? And I think for me personally, the difference is like, what do you prove at various stages of the business? So okay. If at Series A, you prove, well, you are supposed to prove product market fit, and you somewhat have to prove the unit economics. So mm-hmm. you need to prove that someone needs your product and that you can sell that product at a kind of at a positive margin.
So it's ready to be scaled up commercially.
Exactly. So you pour like $10 million, you know how the unit economic works. For every dollar of invested capital, you get $3 mm-hmm. of revenue from customers, right? That's kind of pure math and quite straightforward unit economics. In open source, is in my mind, very different. Why? Because at Series A, I personally wouldn't expect company to have revenue. Because obviously, mm-hmm. the benefit of open source is that you can get community adoption. And sometimes it actually, it is worth much more than getting like 15 customers. Because ultimately in open source, the thing that you prove with your product is that actually there is someone that needs that product and you can get community adoption. So if you get that community adoption and you as a founding team has a clear idea how to monetize that, because it's not trivial, not that many, let me put it the other way. You need to think of a business model depending on the type of the product you're creating, because there are like a handful of business models in open source, and you need to make sure that the business model actually works well for the type of product that you're gotcha. Starting. So from that perspective, if you can prove that someone needs it, like the community needs it, and you have a clear idea how to monetize it, I think we will be reasonably comfortable with you not having revenue. While at Series A, for a more traditional company, we won't be comfortable with that, because we need to see how companies and how customers react to your product.
Gotcha. I have another question that at first glance may sound stupid, but it's not. I mean, if you are an open source founder or team member and your project is very successful, it doesn't necessarily mean you already have any business model. Like maybe not most of them, but a lot of open source projects don't have any business model. My question is, from your perspective, like VC perspective is different. Like, the adoption, the distribution is important. It's also free marketing, kind of, right?
Yeah.
In the end, you need to make money. My question is more about when is the best moment to introduce or even invent the business model. Why I'm asking? Yeah. I'm asking because of my own experience. When we started View Storefront, it was 3 years ago, we haven't had any business model. And it wasn't that easy to figure it out. Yeah. I also talked with Meli Search founders. This very interesting project. Seemingly, they also don't have very, they don't have business model which is set in stone, which is proved. They have some ideas they are figuring out, but the community is already there. It's growing. It's very popular.
Yeah.
Is it comfortable situation for founders and both VC or rather not? Like what cases you've observed or maybe invested on those two sides of the spectrum? Haven't had the business model first or had it just from the day zero, maybe even before founding?
Yeah. No, that's a great question. I think you're looking at the core of VC investing in open source.
Yeah.
So the way I think about that is it's not about whether you have a business model. It's more about whether you have a clear idea how to monetize. So at Series A, where we invest, we expect people to have that idea. If you go back to what we discussed previously in terms of the characteristics of successful founders, these are the founders that have vision. If you want to build like a $5-10 billion company, it doesn't require you to have a clear validation that your business model might work. What it requires is at least initial hypothesis how that might work. Because in open source, and you made a few good examples, in open source, because it's free, right, for users, not customers, for users, it's free.
Yeah.
It's okay to get a lot of community traction because obviously people can start using your product and then they can think of the ways it fits into their paradigm. Where it becomes more challenging is how you can make sure that those people will be able to pay for your product, not will be willing, but will be able to pay for a product.
Gotcha.
Let's take an example. If you're developing something that has to be deployed on premise and the value proposition of your solution is that it is on premise because it provides kind of additional security. Governments and financial institutions sometimes don't like to use cloud and they want to have on premise, right? The universe of potential ways for you to charge for your product is shrunk, right? Just because, well, you can charge for licenses, but probably you can charge for self-hosted version because obviously you can't host something that has to be on premise.
Yeah.
So from that perspective, that should make entrepreneurs think about what are the ways that naturally fit to the product that we're developing. Some products are naturally better fit with some business models versus others. And what we expect at Series A is clear articulation, how you want to monetize it. It doesn't mean that you have to have validation for that or evidence, but at least on a very high level, it should make sense. And from that angle, we probably, on the bulk of the opportunities that we passed on, their number one reason was either lack of talent that would go and kind of build the business function, or B, lack of understanding how to monetize it. And some VCs are more willing to take that risk versus others. I think personally for us, because we're looking for this category defining products. With category defining products, you need to get so many things right from the get-go that we can't afford ourselves to kind of say, well, we'll figure it out like at Series C. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. And from that perspective, we at least need to have a clear articulation how that might work.
Gotcha. So what I understood from what you said is actually that it's not that important to have the business model from the day zero, rather than just, you know, thinking it through from the day zero. If the way you're building your software isn't limiting your possibilities for business model in the end, because exactly. this on-prem hosting is a very good example. If you are offering something which is hosted on-prem, then there will be huge discussion someday about when I need to pay for it. Because if I host it on my own servers, Amazon, Azure, whatever cloud I'm using, but I'm hosting it on my own, I'm taking care of SLA, I'm taking care of maintenance, I'm taking care of security, I'm taking care of a lot of different things. So the value question for the paid edition is very, very significant in this case. Like, if, for example, for me, like open core model, we're going to get to business model in a second, but open core, so we'll have free open source core and then extended enterprise edition is probably the only option that works in this model. And you need to have really huge difference in the features between those two models. Do you agree with me, or maybe I'm wrong?
No, I agree. I think I would phrase it in a way that you need to have a fit between the unique value proposition to your customers and the business model that you can employ to capture a part of that value. Because obviously, mm-hmm. when you create an open source, first thing you do, you create value. When you start to monetize, you try to capture some of that value. And I think it's perfectly fine to have that evolved, because obviously a good example here is MongoDB. MongoDB started, like, the bulk of their revenue was like enterprise grade MongoDB, right? But then actually, if you look at the split now, I've not looked at the recent, but from my memory, the bulk was coming, or the fastest growth was coming from actually a hosted version, because many customers mm-hmm. with a lower ACV, obviously, because these were not kind of large enterprises, maybe a bit smaller companies, they realized, well, we want to use MongoDB, but we don't want to kind of have all of the headache with maintaining it. So we would rather to pay someone and then use a kind of a managed version. And it's perfectly fine to change that, because you understand where the market is going and you try to kind of evolve your product and your value proposition. But what I think is a bit concerning for us is when people say, well, we created this thing, it got like 35,000 stars on GitHub, we don't care about anything, we'll figure it out later. Yes, maybe you'll figure it out, but if you've not thought about that yet, probably your head is a bit in a different direction versus ours. And of course, absolutely. We want to be aligned in our vision in what we think is important at every particular stage.
I'm wondering how it works in two different cohorts of open source products, because I see pretty much the difference between developers tools. You mentioned that you are interested in open source and developers tools, which is which is distinct. And I think this distinction makes a lot of sense, because we have developer tools and we have all the other products. For example, WordPress is open source, but is it a developer tool? Not really. Like, maybe kind of, but it's not. Like, it's a blog platform. But we have also all those developer tools: Webpack, React.js, Vue.js. You know, all sort of different tools. How this works? Because you mentioned between the lines something like you need to target the right group of users, because the users doesn't mean customers. And I think that this is the thing with developer tools, because developers, if you look at developers in general, are not the ones that decide on the budgets and enterprises, and the budgets they have to spend are quite low, like as for the value you generate. How this works for developer tools, what you already said?
No, that's a very great question. I think I would differentiate, first of all, two types of let's call it open sourceness. So one is traditional open source companies, where the open source is the primary at the initial stages, is the primary distribution channel, right? Mm-hmm. Where you use open source to get bottom-up adoption. So you distribute your tool, it's being used by developers, developers start bringing that into their organization. Suddenly, the eng leader from that organization thinks that we need to deploy it in a more structured way. They buy the tool, blah, blah, blah. And then the second part is what I call source available tools. So these are tools that have their code open sourced on GitHub, but their model is not to distribute that tool through open source, because sometimes maybe the people that would care whether it's open source or not are not the buyers or not even users. I think a good example here will be things that are targeted to, let's say, data scientists. I mean, data scientists will probably not sit there and tinker with the product just because it's open source. What they might care about is like security or whether they will be locked in into a certain tool. But the fact that it's open source, it's not the driving decision factor for them.
That's interesting. Isn't it a case of MariaDB, for example, because they have this mixed license? I think they introduced it for the first time, right? That it's open source, but to some extent, after which you need to pay.
Yeah, I mean, there are so much innovation happening on the open source side, and MariaDB is definitely on the forefront of some of that. I would probably highlight here is it's really, if you think about the way the open source kind of might work, you as a founding team should have a clear thesis why your product has to be open source. Mm-hmm. Not because it's fancy, not because it's kind of, you might get visibility like in front of your customers or investors or publicity and so on and so forth. It should make sense. There should be a clear thesis why open source makes sense. And then getting back to your initial point, for many developers, especially if it's bottom-up adoption, they want to have it open source because of multiple considerations, primarily because they don't want to be locked in into something, B, because they want to test the product before they buy it, and C, because you can tweak it. If you want, you can change the product and it will fit exactly your purposes. I think with non-developer related tools, we have probably a bit more questions around whether open source is actually the right way. Because once you open source, it's much harder to go closed source and not to get backlash from the community.
Absolutely, yeah.
If you go closed source, it's much easier to open source later because obviously, well, at a certain point, you might say, well, we want to give back to the community. But I would definitely say that you have to be mindful why open source and why for your specific product.
Absolutely. Good point. Very good discussion. Let's talk a little bit about the business models, because we already covered, I think, two of them. Like, we already covered the cloud hosting versus on-prem, and we also talk a little bit about this model where you have open code, but it's actually not that much open source, like case of MariaDB, where you have mixed license, which is open source to some point. For example, number of users, number of CPUs you are running over, or whatever other criteria you have, and then you need to pay. What other models you saw successful in this space?
Well, I mean, there are not that many that are successful. You mentioned most of them. OpenCore probably being the main driving factor, just because that's where the natural fit between what's open versus what's not comes into play.
And pretty easy to understand by the customers.
Exactly. Sometimes that might actually fire back. For instance, in case of Elastic, one of the primary competitors for Elastic, these are actually not other companies that are doing storage, but AWS running Elastic.
Exactly,
and,
yes.
There was this thing where MongoDB actually changed their license at a certain point, basically not to allow that, in a way that if you want to run like a hosted version of MongoDB and you want to kind of deploy additional features, you need to open source those features. Mm-hmm. And that also had quite a pushback from the community. Another model that we have not discussed, which, well, it depends how you view what success is, but consulting and kind of basically driving a specific version of the product. I mean, Red Hat was definitely a good example of that. It's not per se consulting because their gross margins were quite high, but Red Hat definitely spearheaded this idea that you can take an open source product and you can basically maintain it and you can provide consulting for the clients that need it. I think the question here is like, what is the founder's aspirations in relation to that? Because obviously, if you're thinking about raising capital, you need to understand that the expectation is that you will grow multiple times, right? So if you raise at $50 million valuation, the expectation is that you will reach $5 billion valuation at a certain point. And in consulting, because of the low gross margins and because it's much harder to scale, it's not as easy as like you acquire like 50 customers and they go and use the product, right? So from that perspective, consulting is, in my view, less scalable, but might be more profitable. Because obviously, if you have figured out the way to provide consulting and you're a small shop, say you are 10 people, you can actually run a quite profitable business. And it's perfectly fine. We've seen so many companies that don't want to raise VC capital because they understand that the lifestyle they have with the business model they have, like consulting, for instance, would support what they want. And it would not support what VCs want. And I think it's perfectly fine. And
exactly. That's the difference. It's very hard to invest into such a company by VC, right? Because they are fine with let's say, a linear growth. Usually, like consulting is very difficult to be scaled up other way than linear. If everything is successful, you will have linear growth. And this is perfect. But it's not perfect for VCs looking for hockey sticks, right?
And yeah, exactly. And I actually learned that hard way. So I had an example, not to name companies here, but I had an example where we invested in a company and we persuaded the entrepreneur to actually go and build something big. And obviously that would not work well just because sometimes you need that certain push to create a big company. But in many other cases, it might be the situation where you push someone out of their comfort zone and they're not ready to be out of the comfort zone. And they want to stay where they were and suddenly they will kind of get back at a point where it's fine for them to grow linearly, but not exponentially.
That's a good point. If we are close to the consulting and this kind of business models, maybe I'm going to ask you about the spin-offs, because if you are doing consulting in software development, you very often deal with open source by many different ways. You can use it, like many agencies are using, for example, e-commerce platforms to deploy the e-commerce shops, but sometimes you contribute to those platforms or other tools, and sometimes you are just creating your own software. And it could be even very successful, but how it looks like from the VC perspective, and if you saw many or even any successful spin-off, because I believe this is a very difficult process.
No, it's true. And I think actually there are so many benefits of creating a product inside of a large firm, but at the same time, there are quite many challenges with that. I think a very good example of a successful company will be Confluent and kind of Kafka. Obviously, they started in LinkedIn, and by the time when they went to market, it was already a mature product because they have polished the product inside of LinkedIn. They already knew that it solves the problem, and if it works for LinkedIn, and LinkedIn has, as you might expect, quite high standards for data processing, right? If it works for LinkedIn, it will probably work for all other companies. And they have created a spin-out, which became Confluent, and kind of it's probably one of the fastest growing companies out there in terms of kind of just commercializing something that has gotten a significant community adoption. So that's one example. Another example that is being developed now is, I'm not sure whether you know, but there is this database called ClickHouse that was initially developed at Yandex. Mm-hmm. And then And then basically there was another entity that was providing some sort of consulting for yeah. ClickHouse. And then they were able to get community recognition. And then ultimately they are now developing a standalone product on top of ClickHouse, while ClickHouse is a product that was developed by Yandex. So the cases like that, they exist and they might be successful. I think the challenges come from a number of points. A, how to part ways with the parent company, because obviously if it yep. was developed inside of a large organization, they might have some claims for the intellectual property. That was a very hilarious story where Rambler, which is a kind of IT company in Russia, tried to sue Nginx founders because they said that.
I read about it. Not sure how it ended up, but I read about this story.
It was basically shut down. The claim was shut down because obviously, mm-hmm. first of all, it was like back in the days where Nginx was not a thing at all. And second, because Igor, who is the CEO and the original founder, his responsibilities couldn't include developing anything like Nginx. So they gotcha. Were just trying to get like few bucks on top of the acquisition. So that was quite quickly shut down, which was a very good mm-hmm. case for the open source community, right? Because otherwise yeah. it would have made everyone's life easier. So the challenge is how to part ways, because obviously you want to have a clean cap table if you want to raise VC capital. If you come as a VC and 95% of the company is owned by someone else who is not operationally mm-hmm. involved, I mean, it's not a good setup just because you want to have the upside belong to the founders and the team, because they yeah. will be the one that kind of work 24 hours a day, right? And if they don't see the value that the company is getting, it will be very hard for them to be motivated.
And after the following rounds, they still need to stay with some significant number of
exactly.
shares.
Exactly. And as I mentioned, kind of that's probably one of the primary challenges. Another challenge is obviously thought leadership. I think in open source specifically, thought leadership is something that is an intangible asset that mm-hmm. drives a lot for the company. Just because it's so easy to fork like a product,
yeah.
you need to have some sort of sticking point. Why would community stay with the main kind of branch, right? With the main version and not with a fork. And that's where thought leadership and the founding team actually matters a lot. So from that perspective, whoever is the main contributor or contributors should also become a part of the company. And sometimes they want to stay with the parent company, right? And that's where probably not the best setup is being created, obviously, because they work for the parent company, the product kind of lives by itself and so on. And there are weird permutations or weird incentives between these players.
Gotcha. That makes perfect sense. It's a very difficult process, I guess. I had also an interview with a founder of ContentStack, and ContentStack, a very popular headless CMS, was also kind of spin off from raw engineering, and it was successful. The story is very interesting. Also, one of the episodes will be published very, 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 very soon. Maybe one of the last questions. We are talking for an hour now, so it's one of the longest episodes, but I think it's worth listening to the end. So the question is, the deals you are most proud of and the one you missed?
That's a very good question. I think I would not mention the ones that I'm most proud of because it's early. I think in VC,
yep.
the horizons are quite long. It's like 7 to 10 years. So
yep.
until I see that the deals that I worked on kind of became this category defining, it's very hard for me to be proud of
gotcha.
The fact that I worked on those deals, right? I'm super proud of the progress that those companies have achieved. But personally, I think in VC, mm-hmm. it's very hard to say when you did well. it's very easy to say when you did poorly. Actually, it's much easier to say when you did poorly, yeah. Because it becomes obvious quite quickly. But the one that I missed probably is a company called Circle CI, and you might know that. So they're doing CI and CD. And back in the days, I found that company, they were not raising at that moment. That was like pre-Series B. And we started the conversation. And I obviously looked at all other companies, everyone from CloudBees to CodeShips and other kind of products in the wild. And it took us some time kind of as a partnership to get conviction on the opportunity. And by the time we got to that conviction, someone else was already kind of at their door with the term sheet. So we were late in the process. So I kind of,
yeah.
And it's not only kind of, it's once again, it's very hard to see whether that would have been a good investment or not, because it's early. That was like maybe 4 years ago. So the company still has time to kind of to mature. But just from the community point of view, if you think about CI, CD, Circle CI probably has become a household name the same way as Jenkins is. But Jenkins, Jenkins kind of is a value proposition for a different customer versus Circle CI. But I definitely personally feel that I could have done a better job by just like making sure that everyone is aligned earlier. And hopefully at a certain point, I will see an announcement for that company to be like a public company, for instance.
Interesting. Okay, my last question. I'm not sure if you even can answer, but I will ask anyway. Well, what is the next ideal startup you would jump into if you just can't find it? So is there any like ideal team, product, technology you are looking for at the moment?
That's actually a brilliant question. I think at early stage, at Series A, there is nothing ideal, because if you find something ideal, probably you missed something. And the way it works, and I think that's the biggest thing that ones has to learn to become a VC, is how to be okay with things not being perfect.
Yeah.
And that's something that I'm quite far from saying that I've nailed it. So from that perspective, I think what I've refined for myself is that I want to be damn sure in the team and in their capabilities. Everything else might be not as good as the team, but the team and their vision should be as good as possible, because ideas change, markets change, times change. Many things relate to timing, not to a particular product. And if the team is A+ type, they will figure it out. Because obviously there are so many cases where everything was right, but the team was not able kind of to deliver on that. So if I were to pick one thing to focus on, I would definitely pick the team aspect. Mm-hmm. And then depending on the type of the opportunity, I would be more okay to compromise on other parts, say market, because in many cases the companies that we look at, they don't have large markets. The markets are growing. I mean, you want to grow with the market, or there might be many competitors. I mean, there are so many cases where the market was competitive. I mean, Zoom. we're talking now for Zoom, right? And who would think that something as a video conferencing solution would get so much traction? And it obviously became a huge thing. So from that perspective, the reason why I think Zoom succeeded, and there is a separate discussion on that, but the thing, because the team has been very clear what should be in the product, and they went and executed flawlessly on that specific aspect.
Gotcha. Perfect. Thank you for this answer. And thank you for our discussion. It was great talking with you, Sasha. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much, Peter, for inviting me, and looking forward to chatting soon.
Thanks for listening to the CTO to CTO podcast. If you enjoyed this show and if you found this episode useful and informative in any way, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. This can help us tremendously in reaching other listeners who might also be interested in these topics. And of course, as always, we'll be back with great content next week.